Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to a new edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, and with me as always is my lovely co-host, Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Good evening, Hannah.
Good evening, Charlie.
We're already fighting. Just before I press record, we're already fighting, and it's about something we're going to talk about next week.
Yeah, now I'm really looking forward to next week.
And it's got me all riled up now. I was going to be nice tonight. I don't know if we're going to agree on some things or disagree on something, but now I'm in a mood to fight, Hannah, because I want to have that argument we're going to have next week.
All right, well, that'll give people something to stay tuned for.
Well, tonight we have two major releases to talk about. One we both saw, one only Hannah saw, so she's going solo on that one. We have two documentaries to talk about, and I have a French film to talk about, which always seems the normal thing, like I was in with the French film that you didn't see.
I know, I'm telling you, you are like a shill for the French film industry.
All right, well, let's start off with the new animated film, 2 weeks after Finding Dory, that's going to sweep into theater this weekend and make gobs of money, The Secret Life of Pets. I'm sure you've always wondered when you leave your house, what does my cat or dog do during the day, Hannah? And according to the movie, what do they do?
They get together and party, and they go on little adventures, and they hang out with their friends, and wait for their owners to come home. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, usually it says the cat or dog will sit by the door and wait for the jingle of those keys. Some of the more lazy ones will watch Spanish telenovelas all day. Some of them will raid the fridge. They'll get together at the dog park and gossip and chat, and some will actually have parties. However, one day, Max, voiced by Louis C.K., he's our main dog. He's like a little terrier guy. His owner's Katie. She is voiced by Ellie Kemper. You may know her from Netflix, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. She's Kimmy Schmidt. Mm-hmm. She brings home a new dog named Duke, voiced by Modern Family's Eric Stonestreet. Duke is big. He's a large, shaggy mutt.
Big dog.
He asserts his dominance from minute one. He
alpha dog.
Kicks Max out of his bed. He eats all of Max's food. And he's like, you know what? We're not going to be pals. I'm taking over his apartment. And that is right there, Hannah, where the Secret Life of Pets, which was enjoyable, morphed. It morphed into mean. It morphed into, wow, there's a very unappealing current of mean in this film.
It did. I was so disappointed. I loved the first 10-15 minutes of this movie. It's preceded by a very cute minion short that I enjoyed, and so I was totally into it. I was raring to go throughout this movie. I was excited for a fun movie. You related, as anyone who's ever had a pet, you absolutely related to these initial scenes with with the animal doing everything they could to kind of keep the owner happy and keep them at home for just a little while longer. And the story when these two dogs kind of have to be siblings in this one apartment, and it triggers this this kind of mad adventure through the city that I think tried to be sort of a Toy Story kind of adventure of all the animals kind of taking sides and joining this adventure. It was nothing like Toy Story, and what started out as this really fun movie just for me took a turn, and I didn't enjoy it again until it kind of circled back to the original premise in the last 5 minutes.
The reason I think both of us liked the very beginning and the very end is those are the scenes where the theme is being talked about. It's where pets are providing joy to the homes and the families that they belong to, and it's really nice to see that. But when Duke and Max get lost in the big, scary city, which we've kind of seen before, this is nothing new. I think a lot of people are going to say, ooh, it's a roller coaster thrill ride full of jumps and escapes. And it's not. It's man, Duke, he actually dog naps Max, tries to get him lost. They get beat up by a couple of alley cats. They get chased by dog catchers. And they end up in the sewer with the Home of Flushed Pets. And their leader is very interesting. His name is Snowball, and he is the whitest, fluffiest, smallest, tiniest, cutest bunny you've ever seen, and he's voiced by Kevin Hart, so he's very rough and has an edge on him. He screams a lot, but he's in this little tiny thing. usually, I thought that you think the main villain is going to be the hawk. There's a really big bird of prey in this film, and you think he's going to be the villain because he has the ability to snatch up small dogs and eat them. But no, it's the tiny bunny rabbit, and he has his funny parts. He really does.
Indeed.
The way he leads snakes and alligators and stuff. But and there's a side plot involving a toy dog named Gidget, voiced by Jenny Slate. She's in love with Max, and she leads the search party to help get him back. And this is all plot. It's all story. The kids are going to like that part. But, man, I wonder if kids are going to come around on Duke. Because by the end, they spent the whole day together. They come to an understanding. They reconcile, as they always do. But is it strong enough for kids to come back on Duke and say, you know what, he's not such a bad guy? It wasn't strong enough for me.
It was strong enough for me. At the end, you just kind of like, oh, they'll get along now. And they kind of they're like siblings who challenge each other, and they were fighting, but in the end they're trying to protect each other, and they kind of need each other to preserve their situation at home. And so I think that part was fine. I don't know that the littlest kids will really get the whole down in the sewers, these fleshed animals who hate humans, and just their whole philosophy is, you know, kill the humans. I was like, this is terrible. This is a terrible message. Even if it's meant to be cynical and satirical and funny, I'm not sure that the littlest kids will really grasp any of that at all. And I think they might be a little frightened by some of it.
Yeah, I don't think this movie should be seen by the little one, like 4-year-olds. This is 7-year-old material. Ones that can handle a little bit more PG violence. You mentioned the sewer. They're like a gang. They look down on pets, the domesticated. It's alluded to that they kill them.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Minion short. This movie was made by conglomeration Illumination Entertainment and Universal Pictures, which brought you Despicable Me, Despicable Me 2, and The Lorax. And it stuffs this movie so much with minions, because a minion kind of shows up at the end later, that it's reminding you, hey, did you like the minions? Well, you're going to like pets. Give us some more money. Remember minions? You like the minions? Come on in and see the pets. And it's like, I don't like that cross-pollination there. That was a little annoying.
It was okay. It reminded me that I did not like the Minions movie all that much, and that's why I think the Minions work better as supporting characters and in a short like this. So I like that short better than I liked the big Minion movie overall.
I agree that short was better. I'm glad it was as short as it was, because Minions can get on my nerves real quick.
Yeah.
But it's the same director. Chris Renaud directed this. He directed the Despicable Me films, and it shares the same writers. So it really should have that same feeling, but you know what? The minions were never cruel to one another. The way that the animals here are actually kind of mean to one another. The minions were fun and sporty and lifelike. And even Gru, the villain / hero, was never overtly cruel.
Yeah, Secret Life of Pets starts off like a really sweet, fun animated movie and turns into almost like this animated version of a crime drama. And I just was a little thrown by that. It's like this little, you know, after having seen Kevin Hart in Ride Along 2, you know, it's almost like you could close your eyes and see that bunny rabbit as like the Ride Along 2 character or something.
Yeah. Well, he was just in Central Intelligence.
And Central Intelligence.
Yeah, it's really close because he plays the same character every time.
Yeah, and his voice is very identifiable. And so his character does kind of exude those same characteristics. But I just thought it was just a strange turn that the movie took. And granted, it's nowhere near. Like, anybody who hasn't seen Finding Dory yet should not be going to see Secret Life of Pets first.
You're absolutely right.
And Zootopia, if you're going to rent, that's so much better than this movie. I think that one was a lot stronger. This one, if you've seen everything else, it's certainly better than Ratchet and Clank and Norm of the North. And maybe on par with Angry Birds.
No, I don't know.
I don't know.
Angry Birds is pretty bad.
Yeah, but I mean, this one's probably slightly better than Angry Birds, but not significantly. So if you like that movie, then, you know, you might like this one too. But I definitely would hope that people who haven't seen Finding Dory yet would go for that still for another week.
Well, we owe the truth to our audience. This is sitting at an 80% right now on Rotten Tomatoes. We are in the minority. But it's weird that we agree on this. We should be fighting. Like, Zootopia, we fought over because you really liked it, and I was not as big a fan. But Zootopia is way better than this thing.
Yeah.
And it's so disappointing. People are like, ooh, this is going to be, what a good idea. What do pets do during the
absolutely.
Day?
Absolutely. That's the biggest disappointment, is that it's not necessarily that this movie is so bad. It's just that it's not nearly as good as it should and could have been, because the premise is awesome. And you feel that premise in the first 10 minutes. And unfortunately, it just didn't sustain what was the best part of the movie.
Well said. So lead us in to our next... I did not see the next one. I think it's Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. I missed it because I was doing anything else that night.
See, now, and this will go to the heart of what our argument will be about next week.
Actually, I missed it because I was at another movie.
I don't know.
Or was that I had exceeded my two for the week?
Yeah, maybe. But yeah. So you can't complain about what I failed to see if you failed to
comparing
see.
What you missed and what you're about to talk about. You're giving me ammunition.
But you never know until you see it whether or not you've missed something important.
Did I miss something important
with Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates? No.
Oh.
I mean, you missed something important if you were looking for more Zac Efron and his abs.
I'm not,
you know?
Looking. I just had Alexander Skarsgård's abs last week with Tarzan.
But Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates just falls into that summer, raunchy, R-rated comedy, mindless, very forgettable. I mean, I had to really dig deep into the recesses of my memory bank to even remember this movie, which I saw a couple
you
of weeks
like
ago.
Like 8 days ago.
And whatever it was, it had already disappeared. But it's basically, it takes sort of a standard comedy and turns it on its head in terms of the male and female roles. It's about these two brothers who are told by their parents and their sister who's getting married that they need to bring wedding dates to the sister's wedding, destination wedding in Hawaii.
By the way, that's the most ludicrous plot I've ever heard of. I think the parents would be like, save us the money. And the sister would be like, don't bring strangers to my wedding.
But you have to understand that these two brothers have a knack for ruining every family event in their history. So they're always distracted by trying to impress girls with ridiculous stunts and impress each other with various things. And they're setting stuff on fire. And they're always just causing disaster to happen at every family event. So in their, you know, effort to prevent something from ruining the wedding, they tell them, you guys need to find two nice girls, you know, professional women who you can bring to this wedding and who can, you know, the kind of girls that you can bring home to the parents, and you meet them and they'll just be just these wonderful two women.
That is the thinnest setup in the history of film.
Exactly. And so those two women are played by Anna Kendrick,
whoa,
who I know, you know, is a good actress and talented, and Aubrey Plaza, who seems to me to always be playing essentially the same role. In fact, both these girls seem to be playing these kind of risque women characters. But what they do is they turn the premise on its head, and they get themselves invited to this wedding for a free trip to Hawaii, convince these guys. They see that these guys have put out an online posting for dates, and then they end up like on the Wendy Williams show, and these women see them on the show and then set it up so that they come across these two guys and become these damsels in distress and manage to convince them that one's like a school teacher. I mean, it's just, fabricated. It's very fabricated, and it's silly and it's kind of stupid. But of course, in the end, you know, it's like Zac Efron plays the exact same character, where he's like this good looking guy who's a party boy with a heart. Very similar to his roles in, you know, like in Neighbors and Neighbors 2. and so it's, and his brother is played by this guy, Adam Devine, and he's considered sort of the schlubbier of the two brothers. It's hard to put anyone up next to Zac Efron, but the two brothers have this fierce competition that they've always been in, and it continues into this Hawaiian vacation and wedding that, of course, does not go quite as planned. So it's R for raunchy and absolutely forgettable and completely mindless. And there's going to be probably plenty of 18 to 35-year-olds out there who will flock to see this movie.
Sounds like it has a whiff of Wedding Crashers.
It does. It has a whiff of Wedding Crashers, so it's a bit of that vein. Not done nearly as well.
Like, if this was done 15 years ago, it would star Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson.
It would. And then Anna Kendrick, though, the thing is, she plays this kind of off-kilter chick who's... She should not be going to this wedding because her own wedding had been called off at the altar. And so she's completely obsessed with the devastation of her own wedding. And so she's really on the verge of crazy. And it reminded me of the character she played in Mr. Right with Sam Rockwell, which was so much better.
You've got to be kidding me.
So to me, I thought she was better in Mr. Right with Sam Rockwell than she was playing a somewhat similar type of cray-cray chick in this one.
I don't think we need to spend
in other words, Charlie, you're not going to see it. It's not going to be on your top 10 list for the year. It's not going to be on my top 10 list for the year. But somebody out there who just wants a Wedding Crashers type of comedy, they might go see it.
Why do you always have to end with a silver lining? Like, this is the worst movie ever made. But if you want to see the worst movie ever made.
I'm a silver lining kind of gal. So, you know.
I still want to see it because it might make my top 10 worst.
It could. I don't think it's that bad, though. It's not. Because Zac Efron.
Like, Mr. Right might make my top 10 worst.
No. But it's got a good cast. And so. It would have had to really go off the rails somewhere in a bad, bad way to be like on that bottom list. It's stupid. It's not great. It's totally skippable. So I'll leave it there for you, Charlie.
All right, we'll leave it there. Because, break, we are moving on to something completely different, the two documentaries. And I think, oddly enough, the first one I want to talk about should be the bigger one, but I don't think it is the bigger one. I think the second one is actually going to get in more theaters. But first, we're going to talk about Zero Days, and it's by probably the most famous, most contemporary, prolific documentary filmmaker in theaters today, and that's Alex Gibney. He is a former documentary Oscar winner from 2008, Taxi to the Dark Side, and even just last year, he released two monster documentaries with Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine, and Going Clear, Scientology, and The Prison of Belief. So now he jumps over to, I guess, another... Oh, there's the podcat. He wants to go back to Secret Life of Pets. He jumps over to cyber warfare. He investigates the Stuxnet virus that somebody unleashed upon Iranian nuclear reactors to make them speed up, slow down, and break. And, okay, fair enough. Interesting. I dig it. The problem is, it's slow. Coding is interesting to a certain subset of people, but I don't care how the virus was made. It was much more interesting talking about its consequences. What happened when it was discovered? How did Iran react? And then what did they do in response now that the genie's out of the bottle? Now that governments kind of think they have the permission to conduct offensive cyber warfare, let's talk about what kind of a world we live in now. I wish there was way more of that, and less than, well, I noticed this virus was 20 times bigger and it didn't have any bugs in it, and over here was a 0 instead of a 1. Yeah, it's like right in the middle of the road.
Yeah, and we talked a bit about this during our AFI documentary recap podcast for anybody who might have heard about it then. And so it definitely was too slow for me. I like the concept. I was interested in the story, the whole topic of cyber warfare, and watching the sort of this detective work that was going on to trace back the origins of a virus and to kind of do some reverse engineering of things. It was very interesting, but in that middle section, I completely zoned out or zero-dayed out.
Nice.
So I really did feel, like you said, with all this fun, funky graphics treatment of flying numbers, and I think they probably spent a ton of money on these graphics and just kind of threw them in because they felt like they had to. And I think it forced the movie to drag in the middle when we really should have been just staying with the repercussions of this virus and who was behind what and learning about what's on the horizon and how things could be getting even worse. I mean, it was called, I think, cyber scary, because it was really the idea of just what cyber warfare warriors can possibly accomplish and how devastating it can be worldwide. you know, is something that we all really should be thinking about. So I wish that he had found a way to make it just slightly more accessible and entertaining and tight. I don't think it was edited as tightly as it could have been, and it went on way longer than it should have. It went on probably about 20 minutes longer than it needed to.
It felt very, like a very long documentary. You mentioned you liked the graphics, and it was cool. When you, it's hard to make coding interesting or leave look interesting, like someone typing on a keyboard. So it zooms in to what looks like code and all these zeros and ones and .exes. And at one point, though, he's talking about how there was so much in here and it was going to get bigger and bigger until it burst. And he kept showing like a balloon blow up really big and pop. And I'm like, that is some amateur stuff there, Mr. Gibney.
Yeah.
That's amateur hour.
You had this weird juxtaposition of amateurish stuff and then this stuff that was just so over most people's heads. And so it was inconsistent. I think that's the problem. It was sort of inconsistent in tone. Definitely a worthy topic to tackle. So I applaud him for actually finding something that was of interest. I think I liked it better than Steve Jobs' Man in the Machine last year. I was very disappointed with his work in that one. So he kind of pulled it back a little bit in his favor with this movie, probably just because it's a topic that nobody else has really tackled, whereas you saw like 6 Steve Jobs movies in 2 years.
I think Zero Days is a little bit less than Steve Jobs and Going Clear. I remember I liked Steve Jobs a lot better than you did. But it's probably along the lines of his 2013 film, The Armstrong Lie, about Lance and his doping issues. The most intriguing cinematic thing he did was he had inside sources from the NSA and the CIA, and he obviously, you know, can't tell you their names, and they can't appear on camera because they're spilling secrets. So what he did was he combined their information together and like wrote a script, and he had an actress play the part, and she's all digitized like it's her saying it, and they gave her this digital persona, and that worked for me. I liked it. And actually, for a while, I thought, ooh, they got this NSA person there. You know, she's like, I worked on the floor, and I was there when it went down. And at the end, you learn the gimmick. It is a gimmick. And actually, I think it's a gimmick that works.
I didn't like the gimmick.
You don't like her?
No. And I think that's a spoiler alert right there, because I think you're not supposed to realize that.
No, I don't think revealed. It is. Because you could tell no one speaks like that.
Well, but you didn't really know how that was all coming together. So that was, I think they designed that as a reveal for some sort of shock value. But again, it worked for you. Didn't
no,
work so
she,
much
No, because she
me.
Says, I was hired in 2007 and I worked on the floor and I'm a female. And this is like, if you just described yourself, you just outed yourself. There's like, that probably applies to 3 people on Earth. So I immediately thought, no, that's not. That's not real.
Spoken like a true government insider.
I'm just saying, the way she detailed who she was, like, yeah. If she was trying to remain hidden, that was spoiled. She spoiled herself.
Yeah. I guess I wasn't thinking along those lines when that was happening. I was, that part of her story was just sort of secondary to me, so I wasn't paying all that much attention. I was more interested in what they were revealing, and it was more of a whistleblower kind of a treatment that they were giving to this person. So I thought that between changing up the voice and changing up the look, I thought it was going to be a man. I actually thought they had just switched it so that they had made this
a
male character.
A man,
it could very well have been. That's just it, too, is we don't really know. He gets a lot of access. You know, the guy is very good at getting people to talk. And, again, the topic of cybersecurity and cyber warfare, it's scary stuff. So I think anybody who's interested in learning more about that, and certainly all the computer geeks out there, I think they might want to find Zero Days.
Yeah, this is for computer scientists or probably anyone who subscribes to Wired magazine. And you mentioned he was a good interviewer. He had General Retired Michael Hayden on there, former director of the CIA, former director of the NSA. And man, he had him choking on his Diet Coke, like, oh, you got me. Like, you just straight up on this camera, you got me with that question. And he did. He got him a good one.
There's some clever editing with that stuff, too, that you just sort of nail people who don't want to say anything. And just by holding on their faces and their pauses and their denials or their non-denial denials, then that makes for some very intriguing stuff.
So, yeah, I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. It's right. It's a middle-of-the-road business.
Yeah, it's a middle-of-the-road documentary, for sure.
It's also like the next one, which I also believe is a middle-of-the-road documentary, and I'm surprised it's getting the amount of attention it's getting. It's called Life Animated, and it's by a director called Roger Ross Williams. He is also a former Oscar winner from 2010, but it was for the documentary short subject. I see those every now and then, but I don't remember seeing his. He also directed God Loves Uganda. That was my favorite documentary, I think, from like 2012.
Wow, so I missed that one.
So I was happy going in. I wanted to see this. And then it's based on a book by Ron Suskind. He is a columnist, writer, famous guy for the Wall Street Journal. He had two sons, and when his second son turned three, he lost his motor functions. He lost his speaking ability. What once was a normal kid was now a kid in a shell who couldn't. You couldn't understand him. You didn't know what he was doing. And, you know, this is in the early 90s when the word autism was out there, but not as prevalent as it was today. So, and the whole idea of the word spectrum was not out there yet. So, you've got this kind of heart-wrenching story. My little boy has disappeared, and he's gone, and he doesn't... the only thing he does is, you know, run around spattering gibberish and watching Disney films. And you slowly understand that after a while, he starts only communicating through Disney films. What did you think about that?
Well, you wonder why it is getting so much buzz, and it's because Ron Suskind is a journalist, and journalists are very good at getting their stories out there. And so
it's true, because he went to the producer.
Yes, he went to the he wrote a book. He went and found this producer. He had lots of home video. He had a really good story to tell. You can watch his interviews on ABC News, 60 Minutes. You know, I've seen the segments on this story several times now. So people are already primed to see this. And so I think their marketing of this movie is very good. Autism has only grown in people in awareness. And so I do think that a lot of folks are just primed to see it. And so I liked it. I didn't absolutely love it, but I found it very interesting. And when you see actual home footage, I think the most powerful thing is that this is not a dramatized story. This is, you see this kid in home movies perfectly normal for the first almost 3 years of his life. And you see him in photos and video as he regresses. And to me, that's just so powerful to see. And I think that's what a lot of people are really going to get that emotional impact from, is seeing just how this kid, as the father says, you know, he goes, at three, Owen vanished. Yeah. And that's frightening. That's just frightening. So I think any opportunity to raise awareness and to just show how every person with autism is very different. And so what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for someone else. I think they're very clear in showing that while Disney movies were Owen's way of communicating, that's not necessarily how, it doesn't mean you should go and just show a bunch of Disney movies to any kid on the autistic spectrum and expect them to react the same way. It's just that somebody with autism might find their own way of communicating, and you need to tap into whatever that might be. And so for this family, it happened to just come through in Disney movies, and Owen could recite every single scene and know every character inside and out of every Disney movie. And so he could relate everything that was happening to him in his life and help other people understand what his response was to it through a scene, whether it's Peter Pan or Dumbo or Little Mermaid. I mean, it is rather fascinating, but the story itself, it's not the best documentary, but the story is very interesting and engaging and powerful.
I thought that was the strongest part of the film, when they were juxtaposing him with the Disney films and how he was, what he chose to latch on to express himself. There's something about Peter Pan and Mowgli from Jungle Book in there about why he didn't want to grow up. That was pretty effective. Mm-hmm. So the movie does a big jump from like three, then to eight, and then to the present day, when Owen is 23, and he's a lot more high functioning now. He speaks in complete sentences. He's aware of what's going on around him, and he's in school. He's learning how to become self-sufficient. He's taking self-sufficient classes for when he graduates, he will move into his own apartment in like an assisted living complex. And So, like, half the movie is that, him preparing to transition, to live on his own. Can he do it? Can he make it? We look at some of his friends. We look at his girlfriend. Kind of a heartbreaking situation there. That made me sad, that part.
It was sad.
And it shows his brother. His brother kind of pushes him a little bit, like, out of his comfort zone. He's like, hey, you got a girlfriend. You know, you might have to French kiss. He's like, well, what's that? And he, you know, you don't need to tell him that, man. Like, they're not going to get that far. Just why don't you throttle back?
Yeah.
And, you know, I got bored after a while. There's a part where Owen invented his own story called, like, something.
The sidekicks,
the gang of the sidekicks, or something. Like, all the, every Disney film has a sidekick character, and he put them all into the same story, and they animated that, and was like, all right, I'm losing interest in here.
Protector of Sidekicks.
Yeah, let's get back to the main story, and, like, I'm sure the Protector of Sidekicks is great, but
it was like an added layer to just sort of help understand how Owen's mind was working, is what that was about. But yeah, and they had, like, the hand-drawn animation thing, so you could tell that somebody had spent a lot of time crafting this movie, and it was sort of a step above in the look from so many other documentaries that you might see. So it's very polished in its editing. And I saw there was a Q&A after the screening of this movie with Owen and his parents and his brother. And so it was very interesting to just sort of see that it's not like somebody got better, you know, that somebody had an illness and then they overcame it, and then you see them come out on stage and they've overcome whatever, to just sort of realize that, yeah, I mean, it's the same, that guy that you see in the movie is that guy that came out on stage and was very socially awkward and did really still live in that world, and wasn't, it was difficult for him to really converse or to allow his parents and his brother to answer as many questions, because he kind of wanted to jump in and answer some too. And so it was interesting to see that and to see what the brother goes through. I think that was a big part of what this movie can offer for anyone who's touched by autism, is the pressure that the parents feel to know that they've got to somehow make life as good as possible for Owen, and to make sure that he gets the most out of his life that he can and that he's got a lot to offer. But then his brother at the same time is like this protector character, and he knows that if and when his parents are gone, it falls to him to be his brother's caretaker and provider, and just make sure that everything is okay for Owen in the years beyond, because this is not like some illness. It's like, this is just what somebody, this is how this person lives, and he will live in his world. And it just is about making sure that, that other people can relate to what his world is and understand it better, and then respond and communicate with him better for having that knowledge.
Well, if you said, I hear these two documentaries, you can only see one, Zero Days or Life Animated, which one would you pick?
It would have to fall to what somebody's interests are.
No. I don't care about their interests. I want your interests. What would you go see?
I mean, if I had only been able to choose one for the documentary festival based on the synopsis alone and the fact that I had seen a little bit of the story, I probably would have actually gone to see Life Animated.
Yeah, I'd pick Zero Days, actually. I think it's just a bit stronger, the two.
But I think if you didn't know that, if you were just
looking at... No, but I'm talking about actually having seen them, which one's better, you know?
They're so different. I don't see how they would... there would be some people who would be interested in both of them if they're into documentaries, because I liked both of them.
Yeah.
But I don't think somebody who is really interested in this movie because they know somebody with autism or they have a child with autism, they're not going to give a crap about Zero Days. Whereas somebody who works in the cyber community, or, you know, as we say,
what
who
if the
reads
guy
Wired
has
magazine,
an autistic cousin, but, you know, is a computer scientist.
Well, come then on. they're going to need to suck it up and see both.
Fair enough. All right. Now for your favorite part of the episode. I saw another French movie.
Ooh la la.
This one, though, it's a bit rougher than most, and I liked it more than the others I usually see. It's called The Innocents. I guess in France it's Les Innocents. I don't know how they say that.
Les Innocents?
The director's Anne Fontaine. You might have seen in 2009 Coco Before Chanel. She did that one, and she did in 2013, Adore. I don't know. Okay. I saw that on Netflix. That's Naomi Watts and Robin Wright, our two older mothers, and they start relationships with each other's sons.
Oh, good times.
So, but this one, 1945, December, Poland. So not the most happiest place. The war's over, but you know, you're in Soviet occupied Poland now, and there's the French Red Cross there, and they're taking care of survivors from the German camps. That's, and they're kind of wrapping up business there. In fact, it's about 9 months after the Soviets rolled through, and that means it's common knowledge, it's fact, that when the Soviets rolled through the Baltic states and Poland and East Germany, they raped their way across those countries. They were not kind. And so 9 months after they rolled through, about 25% of the nuns at this convent start giving birth. And probably the worst people you think to be prepared to give birth are a bunch of nuns. So one daring nun leaves the convent, tracks down a nurse, kind of like a physician's assistant at the French Red Cross. Can't be a Russian, can't be a Pole, you know, shame and dishonor. So let's go get the French girl. She is Madeline. She's played by Lou Delage. I remember her from Breathe. It was like a 2014, 2015 film about a pair of girls with a very unhealthy friendship. So I remember she was very good. She's very good here as well. And so she has to be all secret about it. She has to be sneaky. And she goes and kind of becomes the nun's obstetrician. And they, you know, they shun outsiders. They don't want some heathen French girl, some wanton French girl in their midst. But after, you know, the first couple women give birth, they're like, can you stay? Can you help us out here? We have a problem. The abbess, the nun in charge, is Agata Kulecha. You might remember her from Ida. Ida won the Oscar for best
another
film.
Another Polish.
Did you see Ida, though? It won the Oscar, what, 2014 for best
ago.
Foreign? 2014 or 2015?
Best foreign film, yeah.
It was really good. It also won our DC Film Critics foreign film. I voted for that. I thought it was really good. She is, you know, she's balancing what her charges require and her, you know, distaste for outsiders. So she's got tough decisions to make. And you don't know, she's not really a hero or a villain. She's right there in the middle. She can do good and she can do not good. But the one we really identify with is kind of the second in command, Nun Maria. She's played by Agata Buzek. And also Joanna Kulig's in it. She was Ida in Ida. A lot of Pavel Polakowski director people coming back. But man, this is a tough watch at times. You don't want to see nuns. You don't see any nuns, you know, get sexually assaulted. You don't see it. You see it 9 months later, and you don't want to see nuns giving birth. And imagining what happened, because the Soviets stayed there a week, and you know, laws of probability, do the math, 25% are going to get pregnant, and it's what an awful setup. But the ending, not bad. Kind of ends on a happy note. A little too happy, you know. They put a nice little bow on it. Well, actually, you know, French films don't usually do that.
Right.
They leave, you know, you walk out of theater going, oh my God, what did I just watch? I need some pets. I need some Zootopia. And, you know, this one doesn't kick you in the face.
Well, that's the only redemptive quality for me that would possibly incline me to see it. Artie Chick did review this one for chickflix.net this week. So she kind of agreed with you. She enjoyed it. She definitely recommended it. She was not so sure that I would like it, but she also remarked that it's sort of uplifting in the end, and it's okay with it. It makes you feel a little better with how it ends, but there's a, you know, it's all about sisterhood and
you know what it is.
It's a
war film, in fact, about women by women,
right? And that's what she stressed, was that almost always you see these 1945, these war movies are all men. And she said, here you have a film that is all women. And so she found that a very refreshing take on the genre. And so, yeah, she agreed. And she said that it really was not as horrifying as the premise sounds.
Yeah, if you read the 2-minute synopsis, you're gonna be like, what is this?
The 2-minute synopsis was enough to keep me away. The only nun I want to see named Maria is from The Sound of Music. So, you know, that's,
well, what if the Soviets ran over the Von Trapp family?
At least they'd be singing.
Actually, I think you would like this more than the other French films I sometimes make you sit through. I think you actually would get a kick out of this. And it's authentic. It was shot in Poland. It was funded by the Polish Film Institute. I mean, it really looks like this December in Poland, which is not a place you want to spend the winter, you know what I'm saying?
It's a tough call, because as we talk about so often, you know, you only have so much time and there are so many movies to see, and I know you give me a hard time for seeing some of these ones that are very likely to be crap, but they're going to be the kinds of movies, though, that more people are going to find, and they're going to be in theaters, and so some of these other movies are just not going to be on anyone's radar unless they are aficionados of foreign film and indies, and they go seek them out at the art house theaters.
And this was at Sundance, so people who care about that be like, oh, Sundance film, okay, yeah. Must be good.
Yeah.
I want to peek ahead to next week. There's one huge film coming out next week, a very divisive film on the internet, yeah. Which is the remake of Ghostbusters, speaking about women by women for women.
Girl power.
Mm-hmm. There's a film that is my favorite film of 2016 so far, coming out next week. I'm not going to tell you which one it is. Maybe it's Ghostbusters. Who knows?
Somehow I doubt
but
it.
I'm not okay. even going to tell you I'm not even going to tell you the title. But okay. I just, you know, stay tuned next week. I don't give very many films at all 4 stars, and this one knocked my socks off.
Wow. And
I think you, do you have one, I think, that you saw next week? No, that's for like 2 weeks from now.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any that have totally knocked my socks off, but I might have to actually go and find the one.
There's another French film next week.
Oh, my goodness.
No, but this one is by Michel Gondry, Eternal Sunshine for the Spotless Mind, that guy.
Yeah.
So you might have to see that.
Well, and when's that Bryan Cranston one? Is that next week, The Innocents?
That might be. The Infiltrator?
Infiltrators.
That might be next Friday,
The Infiltrators. So, lots of stuff coming up.
So let's recap today. The big, big animated film, Universal Pictures, Despicable, I mean, Secret Life of Pets. Thumbs down.
It's disappointing. I don't give it a thumbs down in the way that I gave Norm of the North a thumbs down, because I do think so many kids want to see this, and they're going to. So it really, the bottom line is, it doesn't really matter what we say, Charlie.
That's
this
true.
Movie is going
this
to win the box office.
This is critic proof.
It is critic proof.
Mike and Dave.
Mike and Dave. 18 to 35, if you're a frat boy just looking for a movie to watch this summer and you liked Wedding Crashers, perhaps, then this is for you. Everyone else can absolutely feel okay skipping it.
Two documentaries, 0 days, about Stuxnet, Life Animated, about autism. I'm leaning towards 0 days.
Both worthwhile documentaries, so pick whichever one really is of most interest to you and go and find it.
The Innocents, you know, you need to up your fortitude a little bit if you want to go watch some nuns give birth. That's all I got to say about that.
I got nothing.
That's about it. That's all you can say. It's good, but it's really good looking and gorgeous to watch these nuns give birth.
Oh, I'm sure.
All right.
I'll watch that on YouTube.
So on behalf of Hannah of chickflix.net and myself, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, thank you very much for listening.
And have a great weekend.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.